Hello, everybody. Welcome to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday, Wednesday edition. This is Tim. Can I remember when Monday night football, Friday night edition, or Thursday night edition used to happen?
Oh, yeah.
Just the special version.
The special, The special version.
Actually, what had happened, Chad Keller, our guest that was scheduled to be with us yesterday, contacted us last minute. They had a family emergency. He apologized. We're going to reschedule regarding the JonBenet Ramsey case. And he has got some really stunning information to share with us. We're going to cover that in a few weeks when we can get back in touch and in line with him once things have settled down. On Monday night, on Midnight in the Desert, I had a great guest on, and we were talking about Stephen King. As a matter of fact, he's known as one of the leading authorities on Stephen King. And as I'm reading through his bio, he's also written books on true crime. So I told him during one of the breaks, I'm like, boy, I'll have to have you visit with me on our true crime show sometime in the future. Lo and behold, here he is within just a few days of that. He was kind enough to fill in for Chad Keller and be our guest today. So we'll get to him in just a few minutes. But we did release Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals yesterday so that you all had something. But I missed a story, Tim.
Oh, all right.
And it's so bizarre. I have to read this and then we'll launch in. There is a high school student that is now accused of serving cookies containing their grandparents' cremains.
Oh, no, ew.
Davis, California police are investigating after a high school student allegedly made cookies containing an unsettling special ingredient. That's what's being reported by KOVR-TV in Sacramento, California. According to student testimony, two Da Vinci High School students were part of a morbid plan to bake and distribute sugar cookies with one student's grandparents' cremated remains inside. Police say the treats were handed out to at least 9 students, and while they're still working to confirm these claims, they'll also have to figure out what crime was committed. This is so unconventional, it would take more research, Davis Police Lieutenant Paul Dorshev told KOVR. He added, I have not heard of anyone getting sick or anybody being harmed as far as physically, but psychologically, that's another thing. The cookies have not yet been tested. Well, first of all, there's truth in advertising. If you're telling me it's a sugar cookie and it's really Grandpa and Grandma's cremains cookie, there's a lie right there. Get them on that. It's a small one, Tim.
Yeah, true.
And Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law, will not help you when you're putting the cremains into cookies. Cookies are hallowed ground. You don't mess with cookies. What is in people's minds? I'm hoping this was just kind of a gag and they joked around saying that.
That's not
but
even
what goes through
funny.
The mind of somebody to say, you know what? Let's put Grandma and Grandpa into a couple cookies.
No. Ugh.
And that your buddy's like, yeah, all right. How high were they when they decided that would be a good plan?
I almost never blame television for anything. But if you go back to the episode of South Park where the guy puts the kid's parents in the chili, I go back to that episode.
That's not just that. I mean, that was Motel Hell, where they were chopping up people. They were actually taking them, burying them in the back, fattening them up, and then they would make them into chili and sausages. And yeah, Ed Gein was reportedly turned some of his clientele into sausage that he would give out to relatives and friends. But I don't think that was ever officially proven, but that's been a part of the...
But a kid of that age, that's the reference, I would think, that they could pull from it.
That's horrible. Just absolutely disturbing on multiple levels. So I saw that, and we didn't get it in for Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals yesterday. And, it didn't really fit in there, but I don't know if we need, a Morbid Crimes, Disgusting Criminals act. But that is one of the most unusual and bizarre stories I've ever heard. All right, let's get going. Stephen Spignesi is our guest. He's the author of more than 75 books, Tim. He's a retired practitioner in residence from the University of New Haven, where he taught English, composition, and literature for 10 years. He writes extensively about pop culture and is considered a world authority on Stephen King, The Beatles, Robin Williams, Woody Allen, The Sopranos, The Andy Griffith Show, ER, and other pop culture subjects and TV shows. His other areas of interest include American history, the U.S. presidents and founders, the Titanic, true crime, and the paranormal. He is here with us today to discuss a brand new book that just came out, In the Crosshairs, Famous Assassinations and Attempts from Julius Caesar to John Lennon. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Dave.
Wow, what a diverse person you are. You're right in our wheelhouse. paranormal, true crime, and pop culture references. Are you sure you're not related to Tim and I somehow?
Yeah, very well might be. We should do that 23 DNA test and see if we have common ancestors.
I'm already in Ancestry.com. Just go spit in a cup and we'll see if you and I are brothers or father and son. I'm sure I'm waiting for that moment, too. So, yeah, what a great, great, well-rounded resume. I like you, Stephen. I like you a lot. And you were a great guest the other night. We had a chance to talk about Stephen King from kind of his background, where he came from, the type of writing he started, and all of the different versions and iterations of Stephen King's personality that have come out in plays and stage shows, movies, books. And you do have an unbelievable knowledge of the guy. And I got to tell you, when I read your list, it's like going down a list of my favorite things. So we're going to definitely have to visit with you more often on Midnight in the Desert, Beyond the Darkness, and I'm sure here on True Crime Tuesday. But let's start off with your book that we're here to talk about, In the Crosshairs, Famous Assassinations and Attempts. This is something I find intriguing because it doesn't fall into the realm of serial killers or what we would talk about in normal crime, but this, of course, hits right in the wheelhouse of true crime and some of the most bizarre crimes in history as well. What made you decide, of all things to write about in the true crime realm, to go after assassinations?
Probably because it's so personal. You know, assassination, it's the ultimate attempt to win. You know, assassins believe that if they eliminate someone they hate or passionately disagree with, that their wishes will come true. Everything wrong about the world for which they blame the victim will suddenly be fixed. And it never works. And so that kind of hatred-motivated or lunacy-motivated crime that's so specifically targeted seemed fascinating. And of course, you know, you go through history and you just see this happening over and over and over. And it's not as though they are, as you just indicated, you know, serial killers or mass murderers or, you know, but it is a form of terrorism because it's basically an attempt to use, you know, the fear that someone could be killed due to personal animus at any time. But it's such a narrowly focused crime and assault that it just, you know, you want to get inside the heads of these people and say, you know, why Rebecca Schaefer? You know, why RFK? Why Wild Bill Hickok? You know, and the thing is, assassination is specifically of a high-profile person. So that elevates it into the realm of being really interesting and something that, you know, people want to dissect. And matter of fact, I'm currently conceptualizing a screenplay based on the murder of James Garfield because his assassin, Charles Guiteau, he had to be one of the craziest people in American history. And I have the transcript of his trial. And the guy, he's innocent because God told him to do it. So God's to blame. Yeah, he got the
God message. God and Jesus seem to put themselves in a lot of bad places, telling some people some really bad things. Either that or they're just completely misinterpreted from their Aramaic language or whatever people think they're hearing. It is it's strange. We did a show a number of years ago called The Devil Made Me Do It, talking about claims of the devil's involvement and not just the, you know, that satanic panic that took place, but the fact that people really believe that they were influenced by the devil in order to do these crimes. And then you have the other side where it is God. You know, I know there was a serial killer, and this was one of the most chilling things. My wife and I had been driving cross country and we had bought this book about serial killers. And she was reading these stories to me, and we were hearing about these. Each one was like maybe no more than 10 pages, just to give you a taste of who this was. And I wish I could remember the serial killer's name, but I found it one of the most chilling. And the whole thing was, when he would set out for that day, he felt that the Lord would lead him, and any house that was unlocked was obviously the house that he wanted this killer to go in and dispatch the homeowners. And it was so matter of fact that this was just God's will. And he would go in and murder people. Oh, that was?
No, I'm saying he wasn't the serial killer, but I'm saying was Poe's philosophy. You know, that I'm not guilty. I'm innocent. And his transcript, he was shouting Bible passages during his testimony. And here's what I love about his thinking. James Garfield didn't die for 2 months after he was shot. And he died because none of the doctors back then believed in this newfangled theory of bacteria causing infection. So over a period, 20 doctors worked on Garfield's gunshot wounds with bare, unwashed hands. So by the time he passed away, a 3-inch incision, which is what they had made, Alexander Graham Bell used his brand new bullet detector, which was kind of like a metal detector to try and find the bullet, which they couldn't find. A 3-inch incision was now 20 inches long and morbidly infected. And that's how he died, sepsis or heart attack. So Gatto's defense was, well, I didn't kill him. He was alive after I shot him.
Right. It's obvious the Lord had it in for this guy because he put every possible wrong person in his way to take care of this. That's
right.
Bizarre.
And by the way, let me intrude with one thought that I had while you were talking about that news story.
Right.
Hannibal Lecter.
Yes, exactly.
Silence of the Lambs. Hannibal Lecter, he fed people to his dinner guests. So, you know, in pop culture and history, there are examples of that. And you may have had a good point about what can they charge him with? Poisoning?
Right. Well, I guess it is illegal, right, to dump cremains because it's a biological hazard. I've got to guess that by putting it into food, it is also a biological hazard.
Yeah, if they you said they hadn't tested them yet, but if they test them and find that, you know, it's true, then there may be a whole spectrum of charges that they can bring against this kid. Plus, mandatory psychotherapy,
right,
will probably be part of the sentence.
Although, if I were going to step in as Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law, I would talk about the fact that there are many organizations now selling these trees that you can become a pod. When you die, they'll put your body in this pod, they bury it, and basically you're the nutrients for these fruited trees, which in fact then your DNA is absorbed into the tree and into these fruits, so people would be eating you as well. Is that any different than what these kids did by entering the, you know, entering the ashes into the food? You know, people are willing to eat without asking. That's, you know, I mean, is that the whole point of, hey, I offered them a cookie. They said yes. They didn't ask me what the ingredients were. And that's why I'm Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law. Maybe not. It's what a bizarre turn. Now, a lot of these cases where you look at this and you reexamine, and I don't want to get into it because I'm so tired of belaboring the story of John Kennedy and his assassination. But do you believe that it was deeply rooted, that there was this dark undercurrent of many people involved in his death? Or do you think there was a lone gunman with one idea, kind of a John Hinckley Jr.?
The one gunman theory does seem kind of far-fetched after decades of research and study, although I have seen several documentaries and read books that say it could be possible. But when you look at the social and historical background at the time and the hatred for the Kennedys and all of these new CIA Cuba revelations that are now, you know, unclassified, it would not, let's put it this way, we'll never really know until maybe they open up some documents that aren't scheduled for another 50 years or so, but it wouldn't surprise me if Oswald was telling the truth when he said, I'm a patsy. It could have been trivial. It could have been something minor. It could have been much more complex. But it's something that we really can't get a definitive answer at this point. And, you know, it's interesting. We didn't talk about it Monday, but Stephen King wrote 11/22/63, an alternate history about the Kennedy assassination, in which a guy goes back in time and stops it. And it's really interesting as to what happens when Kennedy is not shot.
Right.
And King said, you know, his he said he read a stack of books taller than him to do the research on it. And he does talk about the possibility of a conspiracy and so forth. So, it's in the culture, it's in the history, but I don't know if we'll ever know for sure, but it would not surprise me. It would absolutely not surprise me if there was, if there were people, organizations behind Oswald. I believe he fired the gun, definitely. In terms of being a sole gunman, I don't think there was another shot from the grassy knoll. But in terms of motivation, payment, et cetera, it wouldn't surprise me.
There are a lot of cases. There are a lot of people that have examined this, and it's funny to see so many people looking at the exact same evidence that's available to everybody and coming up with such different and in some cases very radical versions of the history and how many shooters. I mean, there's theories that there were up to two or three shooters from different vantage points, from the book depository, the grassy knoll, and like a sewer cap underneath the bridge. So there's right. There's all of this that's bandied about when you look at these type of murders. And I'll tell you what, unfortunately, I share my birthday with the assassination. I was born in 67, but I was born on November 22nd. And every year I'm, you know, instead of really kind of just enjoying the day for what it is, I'm either sharing it with Thanksgiving or memories of the loss of one of, you know, America's most beloved presidents. And I just, that wore thin with me real quick growing up. But we had a chance to speak with Judith Vary Baker, who claimed to be the lover of Oswald. And she actually came into studio with Tim and I. And Tim, I think you'll agree, that's still one of the most powerful interviews we've ever had a chance to do.
It was pretty powerful emotionally, yeah.
Whether you believe this woman or not, I believe she believes everything she's saying. And she, but here's the kicker, Stephen. She brings in this huge scrapbook full of clippings and punch cards and everything, showing her story and narrative, and that she worked with Oswald for Dr. Mary's monkeys experiments and things. And it was a very chilling story to hear come from her. And Tim actually triggered her during the show by playing some music. She got done telling us a story about how they were walking along hand in hand and Lee started to sing a song to her and we had to go to commercial and we come back and Tim starts playing the song. This woman physically dissolved in front of me. And to me, that was, wow, there's something there. This memory is a real memory to her because it hit and it hit fast and furious when she heard that song. And we heard her out. And I'll tell you what, that is the first time that I actually bought into the fact Oswald may not have had anything to do with it and was truly a patsy. And that kind of shaked my paradigm. But on the whole case of assassinations and the idea that it's hard to keep two people to keep a secret, but to have so many people behind the scenes involved in something as huge as killing the American president, it just seems that there would be much better corroboration by now. Somebody big would have spoken at some point and outed this, a deathbed confession or something. I don't know. I'm not saying that it wasn't a conspiracy. Obviously there were definitely things in play when you look at that. And that's hard to dismiss, but it just, to me, it seems interesting that it's so hard in the Lincoln assassination. They ended up, I think, what did they do? Hang like three or four people for his assassination, right, realizing it wasn't just John Wilkes Booth that pulled the trigger, but there was a big plan behind the entire thing.
Conspirators. Yes.
Right.
Yes. And you know, you said it earlier. The key question for a lot of this conspiracy stuff is, how can a secret that big be kept? And we can look at almost any conspiracy theory and ask ourselves, could, you know, matter of fact, I just read a piece about the moon landing that, you know, that Stanley Kubrick filmed it on a soundstage in Las Vegas. And, you know, the thing is, somebody went through the list of NASA employees at the time and came up with the number, and then came up with the number of employees of Stanley Kubrick's production company, et cetera, family members. And it's, you know, thousands of people. And his question was, they all kept the secret for all these years.
Right.
So you're right. You're absolutely right. How could a secret that big be kept? Unless it's simpler, but I agree. I do agree that, you know, that he, like I said before, he may have been telling the truth when he said, "I'm a patsy." That word has such context when it comes to something like an assassination. So, you know, I guess we'll never know. It's not like there were, you know, eyewitnesses that are just absolutely, for instance, you know, I cover John Lennon in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you know, that was absolutely cut and dry, and he didn't even deny it. He sat down and waited for the police. Many assassinations or attempts are not that cut and dry.
Well, talk to me. You say cut and dry. Yeah, talk to me about Mark David Chapman and what your understanding is as we're approaching another anniversary of the assassination of John Lennon. What was the motivation? You know, John Hinckley Jr. wanted to gain the attention and notoriety to hopefully win the love of Jodie Foster, according to legend, right? But what was Hinckley's position in this whole deal?
I've read several accounts and several different interpretations of why he did what he did, using quotes from him and his wife. And it's puzzling and confusing, because it sounds like, it with some quotes, that he thought he would take over, that he would suddenly become John Lennon by destroying the original, okay? And then there are quotes where it sounds like he's jealous that John doesn't deserve the acclaim and the praise and the money that he's made throughout his career as a Beatle and in his post-Beatle years. So, you know, the word that my editor and I decided to use to describe motivation and so forth is deranged. He was a deranged killer who planned out a murder that he felt would fulfill him. The underlying principle of motivation that runs through all of his quotes are that he would be fulfilled if John was gone. And yet here's the paradox, and this is why we went with deranged. He worshipped him at the same time. He kind of wore the same glasses, and, you know, he learned how to play the guitar, and he learned Beatles songs. And so, you know, how can we really understand genuinely deranged people? I did a book called The Evil 100, which is a book about the 100 most evil people in world history. And I actually wrote to Son of Sam and got a letter back. And I asked him point blank, I said, you know, I'm including you in this book, and for what you did. And what are your thoughts? I'd love to hear from you. Do you have a quote that I can use or something, you know? And he wrote back, but he typed it himself and signed it, and he basically said he was someone else. He didn't go into kind of like I was possessed or I was bipolar or schizophrenic or demonic. Or he just said that was a different David Berkowitz. I was someone else. And now he's like a minister. I don't know if he got ordained, but he does religious writings, and he's got a ministry in prison, and he worships Jesus and so forth. He had a major St. Paul moment in prison. So it's impossible to understand. There are cynics who still don't believe him, of course. Then there are followers who say, you know, he's evidence of the power of Christ. He converted him from this other person. And it's complex, it's puzzling, and the cynics will say it's nonsense, and yet the believers will say, well, people can change. So, you know, when it comes to Chapman, it's very problematic, because his quotes and statements about John and what he did are ambiguous. And, you know, he's always up for parole, because his sentence was 25 to life with a possibility of parole. And every, I think, 2 years, he comes up before the parole board, and there's a letter from Yoko at every hearing saying, please don't let him out. I fear for my life. So it's complex, but he has apologized. But the serious Beatle fans and Lennon fans are just, you know, it's abhorrent, the whole notion of what happened. And matter of fact, there are some Facebook Beatle groups and Lennon groups that will ban you if you mention his name in the group. So it's truly hard to know for those of us on a more level plane, so to speak.
We did a show, boy, I want to say, Tim, what was it, back in 2007?
Yeah, it was either end of 2006 or 2007, yeah.
And we spoke, a woman went by an anonymous name, Maria Simpson, I believe is the name she used on the show. And she was friends with Chip Coffey, who's a famous psychic medium. But she had revealed the story to him, and she agreed to come on our show and share it. They were friends with Mark David Chapman when he was younger. And he used to be, I think, like a counselor at their youth group camp, and just tells this remarkable story. And we had this coming to Jesus moment with her that really unnerved her. And, you know, Tim, I don't know if I ever told you this, but it was after that interview she stopped doing interviews.
No.
And, yeah, Chip said that we kind of rocked her world with that final couple of thoughts. And her really interesting story was at one point, just before the assassination of John Lennon, Mark David Chapman showed up at their house. And kind of like at a scene out of Halloween, he's standing in the backyard by the swing set. And when he realized that they had a few other people with him, he just politely took off. And I said, I wonder if he came there to, and I guess they had always believed that he had some kind of demonic attachment or some kind of darkness to him. And I said, I wonder if he came with the specific notion of killing you and your family. And when there were other people, that upset the apple cart, so he left. And she just pauses and she's like, oh my God, I've never thought of that. And then he immediately left and went and took out John Lennon. Which is really, I mean, to me, that was really a kind of a creep factor moment that this guy was that way. And there was this case, and certainly you don't want to diminish and the concept of he wasn't in his right mind and he did this because the devil made him do it bothers a lot of people. Just like DeFeo, Ronnie DeFeo, Butch DeFeo from the original Amityville Murders tried to cop the insanity or the devil made me do it plea that he was possessed by demonic energies and entities that made him pull those triggers and wipe out his entire family. But in this case that we heard from somebody beforehand that knew him beforehand and believed that he definitely was attached with darkness, it suddenly shines a whole new light on his character and what was taking place. So there are some severely broken people out there. And we've come across quite a few over the years. You meet them in passing and you hear some of the things that are being said and done. And then you find out something horrific happens and you just never know. I mean, unfortunately, our lives have been touched by a murder suicide, double murder suicide. Tim and I, we've had other deaths occur around us because of people that became unhinged. And it's real easy to try to point the finger elsewhere. But you realize that you don't know much about anybody because it could hit at any time. Is that kind of unnerving to you as you peel back these layers and research these books and these killers and 100 most evil people? I mean, you just realize that in some of these cases, it could be anybody.
It could be anybody. And very often it is. A real cliche in the true crime field these days is to interview the neighbors and, oh, he was such a nice guy. He was so quiet. And then you find out the truth beyond it. And I personally, my family and I have been touched by the murder of a loved one that became national news. It was on 60 Minutes, the murder in 1971 of Penny Serra from New Haven in a parking garage. And it was enormous news. Mike Wallace, I think, was the one who came and interviewed because one of the suspects was the mayor at the time's nephew who had dated her, so forth and so on. And No one. Her father, who was a very dear friend of myself and the family, he would run ads, Killer Still at Large, and put Penny's picture in the paper, and he paid psychics, he paid private investigators to go to Greece because someone had said, oh, it might have been someone here or someone there. And ultimately, it turned out to be a mechanic from Waterbury, Connecticut. And the way they found him was that a tissue box that was in storage in the Connecticut Federal Repository or State Police Repository had a fingerprint on it. And they got DNA out of it. And the killer's DNA was in a database that did not exist at the time of Penny's murder. And it was shocking beyond imagination that 25 years later, they found the guy. He was tried. The evidence was overwhelming. And he's now in prison for life. And that touched all of us very, very deeply because, I mean, our two families would go on vacations together until finally, you know, the case was solved. But yeah, it's you never know. And again, the killer, it was one of those just everyday guys. And he ended up, she ran into him in the parking garage and he had tried to mug her possibly. And long story short, he ended up killing her. And this was not, you know, the kind of, oh, he like the BTK killer. You know, it wasn't that. He was like a crime of opportunity. So yeah, it is shattering to know that it could be anyone. And it just kind of speaks to the depth of the human psyche and how it can easily go toxic, even while people are fronting every day, going to work and going to church and doing their jobs.
I want to talk more about the kind of the assassinations as well as we examine this. What defines assassination from a murder? You know, from me going out, is it just the level of celebrity of the name that I go out? You know, if I go out and I kill Bud on the corner, who's my newspaper guy, or I kill Steven Spignesi, who's an author and well-known speaker and lecturer, is that the difference between murder and an assassination? Just the level of fame for the victim?
Pretty much. Pretty much. In fact, Chris Rock did a whole routine about that, where people were trying to say, you know, like when Tupac Shakur, who, frankly, I would have called that an assassination. I think it would have qualified. But he didn't. Chris said, no, that was not. He got shot. Schools will be open on their birthday. You know, he said Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, those people were assassinated. This guy got shot. So the point I think he was making is that, you know, the term assassinated is thrown around perhaps a bit too casually these days, and also that it's a nuanced interpretation. But to answer your question, yeah, I consider the level of fame to be and historical significance to be a very important criteria. In fact,
well, you heard that, Tim. You and I will just be known as murder victims, not assassination targets.
Yes, yes.
Our level of fame will never get that high.
And you know, we cover Rebecca Schaefer in the book.
And yeah, that was tragic. I remember that at the time. Unbelievable.
She's only 21 years old, you know, and she was on My Sister Sam. And this guy was a jack-in-the-box janitor. And he was obsessed with her. And he just simply walked to her front door, rang the bell. She opened the door, and he shot her. That was it. And he got caught. The reason that has become an incredibly notorious case and worthy of being called an assassination is because of the mechanism he used to track her down. Back in those days, public records were beyond public. You could walk into the motor vehicle department and get anyone's license and residence and private investigators could get tons of information about people. Now, of course, today they're selling that stuff online in for some websites. But back then, there was no internet. It was just simply, you know, go to City Hall and get this, get that. And that's how he found out where she lived. And anti-stalking laws were passed following her murder in 1989 because we needed them to not make it so easy to find out where people live. So I felt that that was significant enough in terms of history and jurisprudence and culture to simply, you know, include her in the book as an assassination victim. I mean, she's not, you know, Robert F. Kennedy or, you know, James Garfield. But I also included Bob Crane, Phil Hartman. And now, interestingly, what you were just talking about in terms of the difference between a murder victim and an assassination victim, Phil Hartman was shot by his wife, and then she committed suicide. But he was a massive star, yeah, on Saturday Night Live. And so his fame was at the time, it was kind of peaking. He was just on every show, and he was known for his impersonations. And his wife just, you know, murdered him after coming home from a bar and then committed suicide with their two kids in the house. So, again, the level of fame, to get back to what you were saying earlier, is you're absolutely right. The higher profile a person, the name recognizability of a person kind of moves it into that zone where you can justifiably use the word they were assassinated.
Now, let's going back into the history books and digging at this, are there common threads you see between the type of assassinations that take place from Julius Caesar to John Lennon and beyond? Are there, you know, I mean, we've heard some really chilling thoughts that, you know, that some people have, you know, quite a few of the more modern day 20th century assassins seem to be in possession of the book Catcher in the Rye. Is there any truth to these, or is it simply spun out? And one thing I do want to mention, if you don't mind, I get this all the time. People make this, and I understand it's an innocent thought, but they're like, well, murderers always have that three name thing, you know, John Wayne Gacy, Mark David Chapman. And people don't realize the reason they do that is to separate. So when they release in the news that Mark Chapman killed John Lennon, you're not wondering, holy crap, I work with Mark Chapman. Mark David Chapman, when they say John Wayne Gacy, right, and they give these names, they're trying to identify that person and that way. And it has very little to do with, you know, that was their nom de plume, right? I mean, that was just the legal release. Most cases, most murderers, their full name is released in a sense. So unless you know something different, that it's just three, you know, because then I'm waiting for Mark Paul Gosselaar to kill somebody from Saved by the Bell. He's already broken Tim's heart. Now it's just a matter of time before he takes out a life.
Yeah.
But
no, I think you're right. And I think it's for accuracy. I think it's for exactly what you said, that, you know, because names these days are very common. And I think the media and law enforcement wants to be sure there are no misunderstandings, that there are no chances for false identification of someone with the same name. Because if you give the middle name, there can be no doubt who the person is. And I think you're right. I think that that's just a way to make sure that, you know, innocent people aren't targeted based on faulty interpretation of a name being released to the media. So, yeah, I think you're right. It's purely for accuracy.
All right. Now, talk about the kind of consistency through assassins. You know, is there any truth to the Catcher in the Rye being, you know, on hand with many of these assassins when they do what they've done?
Some. You read the backstories and you hear, oh, that they were a fan of Salinger's book. And, you know, interestingly, Dave, remember we were talking Monday night about Stephen King's novel Rage, which is right about a school shooting. and how it was found after it was found in a school shooter's locker. King pulled it from publication. So I think there's kind of like this look to connect, look for causes. But frankly, I mean, what were the novels or videos or video games or songs or movies or TV shows that caused serial killers in the 1600s to act out? I find a problem trying to come up with this equation. Readers of Catcher in the Rye equal potentially, you know, murderous people. No, I have a problem with that. And I've always had a problem with media pundits saying, oh, it's from violent video games or it's from violent movies. And my thinking is, and Stephen King has even commented on this, whatever happened to crazy? There are people who are not sane. And the results of that can often lead to violence, crime, or just nutty behavior. Hear about the guy who jumped naked into the shark pool in Australia last week? He just stripped off, did a backflip, and swam with the sharks, jumped out of the pool, and ran away. And it was like a middle-aged guy. It wasn't a teen, you know, for a frat. What in the world could get into someone's mind where they say, I'm going to jump into a shark tank? So sometimes it's just, you know, the brain is an incredibly complex and puzzling organ. And how people think the way they think and how it causes them to act out. But regarding a common thread, as you asked, and a theme, political and celebrity, politics and celebrity are very often the two traits common to assassination victims. Political people are always targeted, and celebrities are always targeted. That's why that's where they pay for security. So name, you know, high name recognizability, or political people for whom the assailant disagrees with. But, you know, you rarely hear about, you know, a baker or a butcher or, you know, a real estate agent being killed, and then it's usually crimes of passion or there's motivation where, you know, cheating on their wife or whatever. But when it comes to the high profile ones, from my research, it seems to be politics and being a celebrity, being in the public eye, can often be somewhat dangerous. And as my book shows, the people that are targeted, matter of fact, Wild Bill Hickok, we consider that an assassination. And that was because Jack McCall felt personally insulted from a poker game where Jack had lost money and he was drunk and he was filthy. And Wild Bill gave him $1 and said, get some breakfast, Jack. And that so enraged this drunken fool that he came back later that day and shot him in the head from behind. And Wild Bill Hickok at the time was incredibly famous.
Right.
And historians believe that that compounded it, that not only was there was that jealousy issue too. Not only was, you know, Wild Bill Hickok famous and making money with his gun demonstrations, but he was also rude. And so all of these elements combined to make Jack McCall snap and then come back and get rid of Wild Bill. So, you know, motivations and causes and reasons, they're endless. And many are right, many are wrong, many are guesses. It's just kind of paints a picture of, you know, the darkness, the dark side that we're all, that many are capable of.
It doesn't seem that many of these murders are money motivated either, right? It's more about kind of, it's to alter or change somebody's path, maybe for your own fame or to end the fame of the person or their power, you know, kind of a power struggle situation that seems to go down. What were some of the most bizarre or unusual cases of assassination you uncovered when you did the book?
Well, the Bob Crane one has always right. kind of, you know, he was killed by being beaten about the head with a camera tripod. And parts of his brain were found on a suspect's car. And it wasn't, years later, this guy, John Carpenter, was arrested, not the film director. Again, here we go. I wish I knew his middle name. John Carpenter was arrested and charged with the murder of Bob Crane. And he was acquitted because there was no real evidence. And in fact, the brain matter that was allegedly found on either Bob Crane's car or John Carpenter's car, I don't remember which.
It was John Carpenter's rental car, right, on the door.
Okay, then, yeah, right. That was ultimately ruled inconclusive, I believe. And also, he had an alibi. But the thing is, you know, it came in, walked in, and, you know, that was the weapon of choice. And remember the movie?
Autofocus?
Autofocus. Right. He was into videotaping himself and so forth, and Carpenter was involved. Carpenter was on scene for many of the home videos that Bob Crane made, and it just seemed like a logical choice as to who was the murderer, but he was acquitted. There wasn't enough evidence to convict him. But, you know, I've always considered that to be one of the most bizarre methods of death. Guns, knives, of course, and in the back of the book, I have a complete index of all the weaponry used for all of these assassinations. And, you know, camera tripod is in its own category. There are no others. For the guns, I have to describe the caliber and so forth, and the knives, you have to do what length and what type and so forth. But, you know, camera tripod, that stands on its own.
that's absolutely crazy. Yeah, we had Bob's son on our show, who wrote a book about the murder. And to hear the different aspects, I mean, being a longtime fan of Bob Crane ourselves, and Hogan's Heroes and his radio background and such, it was amazing to hear some of these aspects of the case you just never heard before. So it's quite disturbing to realize how much, you know, and I'm fascinated by that too. When you're looking at these cases, and you cover quite a few, the book is called In the Crosshairs: Famous Assassinations and Attempts from Julius Caesar to John Lennon. This is the second edition, and this was just re-released this year. Is that right?
Yes, last year.
Okay, yep. Last year, okay. And when, you know, you're looking at these different cases and seeing the way it's set up, how many of the, you know, were there many where they tried to deflect? You know, in the case of the assassination in Manson's family, when they wiped out that entire household full of people, they definitely tried to deflect and make it a black race thing. Did you find that there were a lot of cases that it seemed like they were trying to put it off on somebody else altogether with the way they handled the murders, with the way that they, you know, committed these executions?
Actually, that's pretty common. I mean, reading through the defenses of these, you know, accused when they go on trial, it's always someone else. If they plead not guilty, they always try to have a defense that, oh, it was someone else, you got the wrong guy. Or they fall back into what we were talking about earlier. It was God. God told me to do this. Very, very few guilty pleas you'll find in assassination literature. Many deny, or if they're caught and they acknowledge the deed, they will, as you indicated, try and pass it off. Oh, no, it wasn't my fault. It was this, it was that. And then you enter into that whole realm of, well, I was forced, or I was being blackmailed. or my son was kidnapped, or they would threaten to kidnap my child, and I had to, you know, you get into that kind of stuff too, and much of it is made up. Much of it is just, you know, matter like Wild Bill Hickok, okay, Jack McCall. He said he shot him out of revenge for Hickok killing his brother in Kansas. And different historical accounts vary, but it seems like Jack McCall did not have a brother in Kansas. And yet his attorney was able to convince this miners' court, because it was held in Deadwood, which was on Indian territory. There were no American laws that applied there. So they just set up this kind of like ad hoc court, and they had lawyers and jurors and so forth. But his lawyer said, could you have had a brother in Kansas and you killed Hickok out of revenge for him killing your brother? And Hickok, you know, McCall says, yeah, a brother in Kansas, you know. So yes, the confabulations, the fantasies, the incredible attempts to deflect, are very common, aside from just outright denial. And then when the evidence is so incredibly overwhelming that, you know, it's just a guilty conviction anyway, you know, like with Guiteau, who killed Garfield, you know, he presented Bible passages and he presented all this. He defended himself. So all of this insane forensic argument that it was the doctors who killed him and so forth and so on. And they deliberated like, you know, 20 minutes and came out and, you know, and that was it. And he was hung and left hanging for 30 minutes after he was executed. They didn't take him right down. It seems like, you know, the whole concept of snapping, that a lot of assassins will, I snapped, or the defense will say, he or she snapped. And you kind of say, well, what is that, a psychotic break, right? And it just seems like an incredibly convenient fallback position for saying I wasn't responsible because I, quote unquote, snapped. And you go look up in the DSM-5, you know, for psychiatric disorders, I don't think you'll see, oh, snapped means, you know, it's just a real easy way out.
Do you, and that whole snapped concept, though, I think that there is a place for that, right? There are some people who just reach a breaking point and are so desperate in their lives, right, that this makes logical sense to them. And then directly afterwards, they're re-engaged into reality. Should we show leniency on cases like that where, you know, circumstance put them in a mental place? And right now there's a heavy slant towards medications that are people are on that are being prescribed by doctors that can cause psychotic episodes. Should that be taken more into context? Should people have, hey, Dave Schrader's not a murderer. He isn't that kind of guy. But they started him on an antidepressant. Right. They started him on an antidepressant for this, that, or the other. And then this went wrong, that went wrong, and this happened in one day. And the medication clouded his judgment, clouded his understanding. And you know, this crime took place. Should there be leniency, do you think, in those cases when something like that happens? And I know that they do examine that in court, you know, with the temporary insanity pleas or you know, they are trying to indoctrinate more with the court proceedings with the drugs and the responsibilities. But if it is found that this is the drug that may have heavily influenced this, at what point are we going to take it up the level? Then should the doctor, who is not checking on this on a regular basis, should the drug companies themselves then be put on trial for this murder because of the effect that it has on people? That if you're giving somebody narcotics, prescribed narcotics that are pushing them to positions where they're hurting others, should somebody else be held accountable so that the law is fully realized?
Well, I think everything you're describing is happening now. The pharmaceutical defense is fairly common these days. In fact, you know, I laugh hysterically at some of these drug ads on TV. You know, side effect could be suicide. And you think to yourself, well, yeah, give me more of that. You know, it's not a situation where it's really cut and dry, but jurisprudence has allowed those defenses into court proceedings. And, you know, having a psychiatric forensic expert up on the stand saying this drug has known side effects, these are the side effects, they've been proven, here's the literature, and I believe that this killer suffered from that. He had a, and they don't, you're right, they don't use snap, but they do use psychotic break. And, you know, pharmaceutically, there are drugs that can cause suicidal tendencies, depression, suicide itself, aggression, hostility. Reading some of the side effects of these pills, you know, you just say, you know, when you hear that, oh, this person was on such and such. In fact, Roseanne used Ambien as an excuse for tweeting. And people bought it because on Ambien, wasn't it Patrick Kennedy who was on Ambien and driving to Congress in the middle of the night in his pajamas because he wanted scrambled eggs? So the impact these medications, the pharmaceutical consequences, can be very heavy and can cause people to do things. And I you know, to answer your question, yes, they're not, should there be leniency? There is leniency these days for those kinds of defenses. Now, there are some who say, you know, it's not justified. Consequences need to be paid. The price needs to be paid for people who commit these crimes. But we have modified the punishments that we give to these people by allowing, you know, like you said, you know, full-time mental institution residency with no chance of getting out. You know, we've got that going on with Hinckley. Hinckley's been in a mental institution since he shot Reagan, but now I think they're letting him out. He had been able to get out on visits and go home and so forth, but now they're petitioning for full-time release. And
well,
that
in
was
that
purely
case, right, the Reagan family, you know, I know the sons and daughters are alive, but now Ron and Nancy being gone, I think that might play a little bit more into this freedom, don't you think?
Well, the problem with that thinking is that the family is terrified in every situation. Like I said with John Lennon, Yoko, she even used the phrase, I believe, in her letter to the parole board, I fear for my life, I fear for my safety, I fear for my son's life and my son's safety. So, yeah, Ron and Nancy being gone eliminates, one would think, his targets. But, you know, the Reagan family is widespread and exists, and so that's the argument to keep them where they are. If they were put in, if they were institutionalized originally, then that's where they belong. But again, you have these turnarounds in these institutions and in prison where people are now cured, quote unquote, or they have found God, or they're not the same person. And I'll tell you, I would not want to be on a panel to determine whether or not a person was, quote unquote, sane enough to be released after committing some horrific crime that was leniently punished because of the drugs they were on, or they were alcoholic, or whatever. It's a conundrum. It truly is. And it's one of the things that, you know, prosecutors, judges, defense lawyers, jurors have to deal with regularly. And it's, you know, would not want that job.
No, not at all. Understandable. The people that are serving these crimes, for these crimes that are in jail, that are, you know, Sirhan, you know, you had Mark David Chapman, you've got John Hinckley Jr., you've got these people that are out there. What is kind of their aspect of this in hindsight? Not the trying to get out of jail free card nonsense, but What do you believe they really were dealing with and going through at those times? Do you get any kind of real sense of who they are? And was this something that was bound to happen at one point or another, whether it was with the person or celebrity they killed, or it would be somebody else eventually?
You know, throughout the whole book and all the research, the motivations were always different. And some, and I hate to use this word, but some were sane. And by that, I'll use the caveat that I mean they had real world motivation, like politics, okay? And then there are those motivations that are clearly, again, deranged, where that make no sense. If I kill John Lennon, I will take over for him. I will be in his place. Or this one insulted me, so he or she deserves execution at my hand. And then there are some where, you know, they feel a political figure is just needs to be removed because of the greater good. And see, that's the ultimate paradox with many of these assassins and assassinations. Many of them really believe they were serving a greater good. And, you know, it's the old science fiction paradox or puzzle or moralistic question. If you could go back in time and kill Hitler, would you? And look at the moral dichotomy there, okay? You're saying you would commit murder, which is like the ultimate, it's in the commandments, let alone the laws, and yet the enormous greater good would be served. So how does one resolve that? So I have determined and learned that motivation was utterly individual when it comes to these assassinations, absolutely personal to the person doing it. And when they're interviewed after, they're caught, and you read those transcripts, and some of them are so committed to the belief that they were doing the right thing, that you just say, you know, where does one draw the line? Where do you stop and say, well, you may believe that, but, you know, the law rules, and therefore you can't do what you did. So, again, it's individual, and it ranges from very serious, real-world political motivation to just delusional, deranged thinking that is allowed to kind of subsume their identity and take over.
And in overall with this book, I mean, this is an updated. Your original version was out, what, like about 10 years ago?
Yes, yes.
What did you add to this one? What were a few of the cases or new insights that you got re-examining this book, re-examining these cases?
Yeah, well, I added Gianni Versace, George Tiller. I'm not sure if I had Monica Seles in the first one, but she's in this one. A Dutch queen who was, there was an assassination attempt made, Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands. We added her. We found an attempt in the records on George W. Bush. And so basically what we tried to do was bring it up to date in the decade following the original publication, or even more than a decade, and added a few cases. You know, the thing with that is there were many more, Dave, than we could have added. But we just went with, again, high profile names, you know, the things that people would say, oh, yeah, like Queen Beatrix, you know, she's royalty. Royalty has incredible security these days because of the climate. So the update includes some people that didn't make it in the first, but again, was clearly, you know, an attempt to eliminate someone high profile, like when Monica Seles was stabbed, you know. Unexplainable, completely can't be understood by rational people. But it happened. And so we felt that it was time. Unfortunate. Isn't that sad? unfortunately, that this book can be updated regularly. I just think, you know, it's a true crime book. It's important to keep the history alive. Keep this stuff in the forefront of our popular culture and our history so that we're constantly aware. Historians, you know, that's what they do. I consider this a history book. And again, it did, when we were talking about doing the update, and I said, you know, it's just awful that enough has happened, terrible things, that we could do a new edition. And frankly, I could update it now and add more, which is kind of disconcerting. But it's the reality of the world we live in today, isn't it?
Do you think, personally, knowing what you know about crime, do you think that things are getting worse, or are they status quo, or are we seeing it as it's always been?
Actually, it's getting better. If you look at crime stats across the board, let's just say America, crime is down. Look at the FBI reports. Matter of fact, did you see the news last week? Was the first shooting-free weekend in New York in how many years? 6 years, 8 years, something like that? No, I think that media, the bulk of media, fearmonger. And I think it's because they are commercial entities. And I think the biggest mistake the American government ever made was when they were negotiating the contracts with TV networks to use the public airways, that they made 1 hour a day, kind of, they carved that out for news programming, which became the 6 o'clock news. But they did not prohibit selling ads on the news. And I didn't come up with this. Many, many people have said, if the news programs, the 6 o'clock news, and both the local and network, had never been allowed to sell ads, and that it was just pure programming, things would be gravely different. Because, you know, the old saying, I have friends that work at my local station, WTNH Channel 8, and, you know, one of the things we were talking about was, he said to me, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. You've heard that.
Right.
And so murders, car crashes, fires, hurricanes, any school shootings, you know, assaults, anything bad. Crime news leads the news when we really need to know about so much more. And yet, if it bleeds, it leads. And that's specifically due to having to keep eyeballs on that channel because to keep the ad rates up. So I think that media fearmongers. And it's kind of like a necessity for them. It's for survival. And so people are always believing, you know, if there's an incident in a small town in Iowa that's kind of horrific and it's broadcast all over the country, people will, oh, my God, that's terrible. And yet there is no context. They're not told that, well, this is like a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of crime that day occurred. And yet, you know, the billboarding with the graphics and the music and the sound and all this stuff just terrifies people. So everyone thinks crime is worse than it's ever been. Reality is that it is better than it has ever been. But of course, there's always the people who will extrapolate one mugging to, it's terrible out there. You can't walk the streets. Now, of course, you and I know there's some truth in that. You know, you got to be careful walking in dark alleys at night and so forth and so on, just sheer protection. But, you know, it's not anywhere near what, you know, the statistics show. And, you know, it's like facts, you know, facts matter. And yet there isn't that tendency to not placate, but tone down. it's very garish. It's very, you know, kind of headline oriented and sensationalistic. And, you know, I mean, if there's a car crash on a highway in Connecticut, it's on every news station that night. And it turns out it might have been like a crash. And, you know, it closed the lane for an hour. And it was cleared, and one guy was taken to the hospital with a bad neck or whatever. And yet, everyone is talking, oh, my God, you hear about the big accident, you know, traffic was tied up. And there's that kind of tendency to be afraid. And really, how many hundreds of thousands of vehicles traveled that exact spot that day with no problems whatsoever, but that one little thing? So to answer your question, no, I don't think that crime is anywhere near as horrific as some of the media leads us to believe. And again, just look at the statistics. Look at the FBI reports for burglary, assault, rape, murder. I mean, just look at them, and you'll see the trend is down.
You know what, though? Here's the scary thing that you say that. And again, talking about what you can trust with the way the media releases it, sometimes the media is manipulated behind the scenes. I am friends with somebody who's very connected in the city of Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And we just had this discussion a week ago on another radio show. And he said, right now we're considered the safe place. He goes, you have no idea what they're doing and what they're hiding. He said, you know, the police are being told, hey, if something happens, hold off. Let's see if it resolves itself before going in. Because as soon as they go into the call, it becomes something that they have to document. And if they just let it unfold for 10 or 15 minutes and the fight breaks up and people goes home and there's no arrests made, the crime level seems to be going down. But he said it is astounding the type of calls that come in that just go unresponsive, or that they'll wait 15 minutes before sending the police out to. And in this case, I often wonder if we are being manipulated, not necessarily by media, who has a stake in the game, but what they're even being allowed to know. What I was told was, the politicians that are behind this and the people that are trying to run the kind of Visit Minnesota thing are burying these stories. And it was some astounding number. We're like number fourth or sixth in the nation for rapes in Minneapolis. I had no clue. And violent crimes in the city of Minneapolis. And it is unbelievable, but you don't hear it living in Minneapolis. You just don't hear how many things are going on. As a matter of fact, the guy that I was speaking with has an actual recording from the police scanners at the time that there was somebody, they were driving down one of the main strips in Minneapolis with the back hatch open, and they were shooting with an AR out the back, and it was being called in, but they weren't doing anything about it because nobody died. They buried the story.
Sure. So I don't know if crime is really dipping.
I don't know if it's dipping.
When you factor in corruption and political manipulation, yes. My theory goes out the window if we can't trust the statistics. But in general, I guess my point is that the fear-mongering is real, and when they do choose to report something, it's not treated like, you know, soberly. And so perhaps that contributes to it overall. But you're right. If there's corruption in both police reporting or anything, crime stats and so forth, then, yeah, my theory goes out the window. And it could be much worse than stats show. So again, it's how much can we trust science? How much can we trust the statistics if they're being manipulated, as you say, you know, from behind the scenes? But we got to start somewhere. So you know, I just see this overall trend of sensationalism. Let's put it that way. Let's say that rather than just down and out blatant fear mongering, the news today is reported when it is reported with a definite bent toward sensationalism. And I think that is a misuse of the airwaves. And I don't think it's editorially fair. You know, I'm an editor as well as a writer. And, you know, tone makes it, you know, you're a writer, it makes a huge difference in the way people perceive things. And that's a big part of what's going on these days, where the tone of the news report can often kind of skew toward sensationalistic, fear-mongering, scary, and when there really isn't much need. And the proof of that, or what I would offer as evidence, is the news cycle. Something is absolutely horrendous, and 24 hours later, it's forgotten. It's gone. Never cited again. Never mentioned again on the news. No follow-ups. No reassurance that things have been resolved, unless there's a major development that somehow kind of, you know, solves the problem or solves the case. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I can't thank you enough. I mean, it's been a fascinating look, and we will put up a link to the book as well on today's podcast so people can find it, In the Crosshairs, Famous Assassinations and Attempts from Julius Caesar to John Lennon. This is the second edition. It just came out last year. It is available, and we'll have that link on our site. Stephen Spignesi, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I guess we're just going to be new buddies. We'll have to have you back on the show more often for Midnight in the Desert, Beyond the Darkness, and here as we continue our journey into the strange and pop culture and true crime together. So thank you for doing this, Stephen.
Say the word and I'm there for you. It was a pleasure, and thanks to both of you.
Great. All right, we're going to cut out. Thank you guys for your patience and understanding regarding our guest yesterday. And hope it was worth your time to come on in and check out the show today. We'll be back again with you next Tuesday with another brand new episode of the Best in True Crime Talk Radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. And this is True Crime Tuesday.